Cambridge that a few years before had first split the atom. All of this, Yeats means to evoke by making him a student at Cambridge. It backs up the notion that he is a hard, very penetrating, skeptical intelligence. And one could go on with much else. Actually, in terms of stagecraft and the theatre, this is not my speciality, and so I speak without authority, but it seems to me an extremely accomplished job. You still hear it said that that Yeats was no playwright. This, I think, is a... I suspect strongly that this is the result of the continuing notion among old-fashioned people in the theatre that only the realistic theatre of Shaw or later, Miller, perhaps, in this country, Tennessee Williams, that this is the only sort of drama that is serious. Yeats, by this time, as an old man, he had been working actually in the theatre for something like 35 years, no longer than that, 40 years. Various theatres. He had created a theatre of his own. He had directed it. He was not, in other words, a man of letters who merely writes a play in his study and then sends it off, hopefully, for theatre people to adapt if they can. He wrote, by this time, from immediate experience of just what would go and what would not go on the stage. And indeed, he had specific actors in mind, a specific Abbey Theatre company. As he composed it, here was a part for this actress, here was a part for this other actor. Perhaps the next thing to take up about the words upon the window pane is something which some of you have asked me about already after class, and which must be in the minds of many of you, and this is a large question. How seriously do we take Yeats's spiritualism and his continual interest in the occult? The question, did Yeats really believe in fairies? Did Yeats really believe in ghosts? Did Yeats really believe that the spiritualistic medium could make contact with the spirit world? Most notable of those mediums, of course, in his life being the woman that he married, very down-to-earth, shrewd, commonsensical English woman many years younger than himself, whom he married, you remember, very late in life, and who had no sooner married him than she turned out to have spiritualistic, mediumistic faculties that she, like everybody else, had not dreamed of before. How far did Yeats believe all this mumbo-jumbo? Well, it's a question that is not easy to answer. I think one can say firmly this, however, that Yeats nowhere, you can hunt high or low, neither in conversation, nor in letters, nor in published writings, does he specifically say, I believe thus, thus, and thus. After all, he too was, in his way, a highly skeptical man. He'd inherited it from his father. Father, you remember, was the first in a long line of Yeats clergymen who found it impossible to accept the supernaturalism of the Christian revelation. And there is no evidence that his son, William Butler, the poet, was ever tempted back into the supernaturalism of the Christian faith. Well, it would be very odd, though it's not unheard of, it's true, that someone who can't accept the supernaturalism of Christianity should be able to accept the more unstructured and untraditional supernaturalism of Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy. The biography, which I put among your recommended books, Elman's Yeats, the Man and the Masks, is really very good about this, and will give the will give a great deal of help to people who are really concerned about this. Elman points out that Yeats's attitude, he was fascinated by the supernatural, but his attitude was ultimately thereto scientific. He was going to have proof, to get proof. He was was interested in psychic phenomena, and there is no evidence that he ever got proof really to satisfy him. He kept being interested. So that John Corbett, the skeptic in this seance, represents Yeats as much as any of the others do, and indeed rather more than, for instance, old Cornelius Patterson, who thinks that in heaven they run whippets and go to horse races. Mrs. Mallet, who's an English woman wondering about setting up a small business in Folkestone and wants to consult her dead husband about whether this is a usual thing to do. All of this, of course, is the comic side, the comic and grotesque element in spiritualistic activities. Yeats is very well aware of, and certainly allows for in this play. I mean, there are moments of high comedy in the play. Wow. He did, in fact, write a long introduction to this play, in the second half of which he does, in fact, take up this issue. And it is an essay which I'm going to ask you to read. In fact, you might take a note of it now. His preface to Words Upon the Wind, his introduction to it. You'll find it in various collections, some of which are on reserve. For instance, it is in this book, Explorations, which is a collection of essays and introductions in prose. Very important essay. More important from our purposes, I believe, in the first half of it, which is about Yeats's politics, and about what, and about his fascination with and admiration of Swift. That's the second half about the psychic is also interesting. In terms of the play, quite plainly, this is a hypothesis, a convention which you can accept or not. It is not true that if you are firmly convinced that the spiritual realm does not communicate with the physical realm of living beings through persons with curious mediumistic powers, this does not destroy the interest of the play. You then accept it as a convention, just as you accept Shakespeare's ghosts as a convention, or just as you accept the dancing, whirling phantoms of Dermot and de Vaugilla in The Dreaming of the Bond. So it shouldn't throw anybody. It's worth saying something now about the curious situation in which Yeats now found himself in the 1920s and 1930s. And he's very frank about this too in the introductory essay. Born in the 1860s, remember, and brought up, in terms of time, rather more in London than in Ireland, he, of course, shared the literary assumptions of that time, that is to say, they had inherited Romanticism. For them, poetry was represented above all by William Blake and Shelley, and they accepted, as all the Romantic and Victorian critics and readers and poets, with very few exceptions, did, that the 18th century was barren. This was an essential contention of Romantic and Victorian periods. And Yeats himself imbibed this in his youth, his first admirations. You can see them clearly from those early poems that were being read in the film yesterday, were in fact with high Romantic writers like Blake, like Shelley, and then later ones like Dante Gabriel Rossetti and William Morris. And so it took him a long time to come round to this interest in the 18th century, the age of Pope, the age of Swift, the age of Burke and Goldsmith. We have already seen the pressures which drove him towards that, and again he's quite explicit about that in the introduction. It's a very honest piece of writing, a remarkable piece of writing. It was, of course, Irish history, in particular the history of the Anglo-Irish, which forced him into the 18th century. But it gets him into a considerable difficulty, and he doesn't make the switch easily. He has, as it were, to unlearn a great deal of his early romanticism in order to get himself into a state of mind in which he can esteem the great century of Anglo-Irishness, which is undoubtedly the 18th century. And he doesn't do this in a hurry. It takes a long time. Here he talks, for instance, of two men he'd known in his youth, John O'Leary and J.F. Taylor, and then he speaks of himself more extreme in such things than Taylor and O'Leary, who often seem to live in the 18th century to acknowledge its canons alone in literature and in the arts. I turned from Goldsmith and from Burke because they had come to seem a part of the English system. From Swift, because I acknowledged, being a romantic, no verse between Cowley and Smart's Song to David, no prose between Sir Thomas Browne and the Conversations of Lamba. That's to say, the whole of the 18th century left out, as it basically is, for the most part, by people brought up in the romantic tradition. After all, the two pioneering earliest romantics in England, very different ones, romantic poets, William Blake and William Wordsworth, both defined what they were after by pronouncing a sort of anathema upon the 100 years which had preceded them. And Yeats, like virtually any young man, literary young man, brought up in his generation, accepted this. He's best so here. I turned from Goldsmith and from Burke, because they seemed a part of the English system, from Swift, because I acknowledged, being a romantic, no verse between Cowley in the 17th century and Smart in the very late 18th century, no prose between Sir Thomas Browne of the 17th century and the Conversations of Lando in the 19th century. But now, he goes on, but now I read Swift for months together, Burke and Berkeley less often but always with excitement, and Goldsmith lures and waits. I collect materials for my thought and work, for some identification of my beliefs with the nation itself. I seek an image of the modern mind's discovery of itself, of its own permanent form, in that one Irish century that escaped from darkness and confusion. That one Irish century that escaped from darkness and confusion. And it's history that forces him to recognize this. I would that our 50th, 16th, or even our 17th century had been the clear mirror, but fate decided against us. He's committed to the 18th century. And he goes on, Swift haunts me, he is always just round the next corner. And then he particularly comments in the essay upon some of the things which the young John Corbett, which John Corbett in particular says in the play. You remember that, to begin with, Dr. Trench comes in bringing John Corbett, introduces him to the secretary, Miss McKenna, and then there's a certain amount of desultory conversation, very important though, of desultory, between Trench and Corbett, while Miss McKenna welcomes the next few guests who arrive later, and they all wait for Mrs. Henderson, the medium, who's come over from England at some expense, to come down and conduct the seance. Perhaps the most interesting begins to be interesting when Dr. Trench says, Miss McKenna's gone out and they're left alone, and this is the first time Corbett has been in this Dublin house, and Trench says, it was a private house until about 50 years ago. It was not so near the town in those days, and there are large stables at the back. Quite a number of notable people lived here. Grattan was born upstairs. No, not Grattan, Curran, perhaps. I forget. But I do know that this house, in the early part of the 18th century, belonged to friends of Jonathan Swift, or rather of Stella. Swift chapped her in the journal to Stella because of certain small sums of money she lost at cards, probably in this very room. That was before Vanessa appeared upon the scene. It was a country house in those days, surrounded by trees and gardens. Well, there's Grattan. We know who Grattan is by this time. Henry Grattan, the the great prototypical name of the Anglo-Irish gentry culture in the second half of the 18th century, when it was asserting itself as distinct from England, or attempted to. Curran, John Philpot Curran, we may say something about next week, he is another prominent parliamentary orator and gentleman of Anglo-Irish patriot. Stella and Vanessa are, of course, the two women mysteriously in Swift's life, and what we hear later on is an attempt, when the spirit of Swift takes over the seance speaking through the medium, from one point of view and on one level, the play is an attempt to explain the puzzle of Swift's ambiguous relationships with these two women. And when the medium is in a deep trance, instead of getting the people to speak to the spirits whom the guests have come for, she is taken over, and therefore the entire seance is taken over by two voices, one female and one male. And the female voice, one realizes, is that of Vanessa, Esther Van Omri, the English woman who had been Swift's pupil when he was in England, who fell in love with him, so much older than she was, and followed him to Dublin. And what we hear first is Vanessa, a scene, as it were, which they are playing over, reenacting from the past, as they are condemned to do, that the Dermot and de Vaugilla were condemned to live over as unquiet spirits, just as the people in purgatory are committed to living over again the calamity which is the end of the great house of Castle Dargan. So Vanessa and Swift reenact this dialogue, in which Swift first begins by reproaching Vanessa for having attempted to probe what the true nature of his relations were with the other woman in his life, Stella. And then she appeals to him quite explicitly in what I think is in many ways the most beautiful, one of the most telling and significant passages. Pleads with him. She knows that he's a man of normal passions. He's old. She loves him. Why will he not make the relationship a sexual one? And his answers are furious, passionate, tormented. Plainly, it is not simply that he isn't tempted, that he isn't attracted. And then at a later stage, the medium being possessed by Vanessa in the trance falls to the floor. And then at a later stage, we hear Swift's own voice taking over and talking about Stella rather than Vanessa. Before we get to that, however, some of the quite different issues have been set up. The notion that we just had about this was the house that Grattan and Curran were in is one of them. Then Trench shows John Corbett the words cut with a diamond in the old, on the old glass of the old window, and introduces them as, says they're Stella's. He quotes some of them. There is no such house. There are no such lines cut on a window pane. But such things do certainly survive. There is still a pane of glass in Trinity College Dublin on which Oliver Goldsmith wrote lines of verse with a diamond. So it's realistic in that sense. John Corbett, it turns out, is besides being interested in psychic phenomena, is in fact working in Cambridge on Swift and trying to understand Swift. So that the sort of information which any audience needs about Jonathan Swift can in fact be supplied to them and is supplied to them by John Corbett in the play. They've got to be very attentive to get all the information that's necessary, and I think the reason why the play is so seldom put on is that it's a lot to ask of a modern audience. They keep alert. And if they miss any of the information that Corbett gives them, then they don't make any sense of the play at all. And then, after they've looked at this, Dr. Trench says admiringly, I have shown that writing to several persons, and you are the first who have recognized the lines. And then Corbett replies, I am writing an essay on Swift and Stella for my doctorate at Cambridge. I hope to prove that in Swift's day, men of intellect reached the height of their power, the greatest position they ever attained in society and the state. That everything great in Ireland and in our character, in what remains of our architecture, comes from that day. That we have kept its seal longer than England. Well, the patriotic thrust of that is quite plain. But it is what Corbett says is not limited to this was the greatest period of Ireland or of Anglo-Ireland. He says specifically, I hope to prove that in Swift's day men of intellect reached the height of their power, the greatest position they ever attained in society and the state. Any society and any state. Thus, the politics that Yeats is alluding to in the play through Swift, and which is expounded far more fully in the introduction, is not simply a politics for Ireland. It is about politics in general. And as we will expect from this time period, and as you can see from some of the other things that Corbett then says about Swift, it is, in most senses of the term, profoundly anti-democratic view of the state and of the political constitution of the state that Yeats espouses at this time. Indeed, in the introduction to The Words Upon the Window Pane, he explicitly refers admiringly to the Italy of Mussolini. Mussolini is not named, but he talks of the man who has emerged in Italy and who is pulling Italy together. Remember that although this was written in Ireland, it was written in Galway, in fact, as we carefully said at the front, in memory of Lady Gregory, in whose house it was written. She very lately died, and he had written it in her house, Cool Park, in County Galway. Still, Yeats at this period, in the late 20s and early 30s, was spending as much time in Italy as in Ireland or England. He and his wife went for long periods to be with their friend Ezra and Dorothy Pound and with the international group of expatriates which had settled at that time in Rapallo in Liguria, the Italian coast. We've seen a great deal of Pound, and there is no doubt, therefore, he was already a long way into the fascism to which Pound had virtually already committed himself. And so there is here an attempt, by implication, an implication which is spelled out in the preface, to, in fact, put forward something like a fascist alternative to the egalitarian democracy which Pound and Yeats alike had come to dislike. This, in fact, emerges, though only by implication, in what follows. Dr. Trench says, a tragic life. Bolingbroke, Harley, Ormond, all those great ministers that were his friends, banished and broken. These three names belong to the period that I briefly alluded to when I was doing the most rapid thumbnail sketch of Swift's life some two or three classes back. The period when Swift was nearest to the positions of real power in England, and that was very near indeed, were the period, the 2 years, 1711 to 1713, immediately before Queen Anne died. And these were the Tory ministers, all his friends, whom he and Pope and others were able to influence. It was a period, indeed, when the principal men of letters of the time, a very brief period, 2 years, when the men whom we now recognize as the greatest literary geniuses of the time were immediately in contact with the men who were the most powerful ministers of the state. And hence, what Corbett has just said before, in Swift's day, men of intellect reached the height of their power, the greatest position they ever attained in society and the state. These three names, Bolingbroke, Harley, Ormond, are the three Tory ministers, all of whom were thrown from power when the Queen, so inopportunely for them, died. All of them were impeached by the Whig opposition. All of them were accused of having Jacobite sympathies. And this is, seems indeed that they did. That is to say, they were prepared to do a deal with the exiled Stuarts. Bolingbroke was allowed back after a while, and then re-entered political life in England through a long career. Harley, who later became Earl of Oxford, died within a few years, retired from politics and died within a few years. Ormond is a name that we've met with, and it so happens that the son of the great Duke of Ormond, in fact, was a Tory, and in fact, had Jacobite sympathies, and so he had to flee the country and live in exile. All those great ministers that were his friends banished and broken. Corbett replies, I do not think you can explain him in that way. His tragedy had deeper foundations. His ideal order was the Roman Senate. His ideal men, Brutus and Cato. Such an order and such men had seemed possible once more. But the movement passed and he foresaw the ruin to come. Democracy, Rousseau, the French Revolution. That is why he hated the common run of men. That is why he wrote Gulliver. That is why he wore out his brain. That is why he felt saeva indignatio. That is why he sleeps under the greatest epitaph in history. You remember how it goes. He was telling us again, because we don't do those. And also he's going to translate it for us, because it's written in Latin. You remember how it goes. It is almost finer in English than in Latin. He has gone where fierce indignation can lacerate his heart no more. Now all of that is expounded and elaborated in the introductory essay. And in a very moving passage. It comes where Yeats quotes in the preface another thing that in the play John Corbett says. In the play John Corbett says, everything great in Ireland and in our character, in what remains of our architecture, comes from that day. We have kept its seal longer than England. That's what he said. Yeats in the essay comments, the overstatement of an enthusiastic Cambridge student, and yet with its measure of truth. The Battle of the Boyne overwhelmed a civilization full of religion and myth, and brought in its place intelligible laws planned out upon a great blackboard. Capacity for horizontal lines, for rigid shapes, for buildings, for attitudes of mind that could be multiplied like an expanding bookcase, a modern work. So how can he approve it? This is precisely the geometrical rigidities of precisely what a romantic mind like his most hates. So how can he acknowledge this and still venerate Swift and Berkeley and others, particularly Swift? Well, case is made immediately, he goes on. The modern world and something that appeared and perished in its dawn, an instinct for Roman rhetoric, Roman elegance. And that is obviously what John Corbett is alluding to. He is supposing that there was a moment after the Battle of the Boyne, after the coming of the modern world, a sort of moment of equilibrium represented at any rate in Ireland by the Anglo-Irish civilization of Swift, Grattan, Berkeley, Burke, to some degree in England by their analogues, and doubtless elsewhere in Europe, you would agree, which recovered the Roman sense for the civic. So here you begin to see the whole thing tying together. Ancient Rome, he's going to remind us in a little while in the essay that Swift's first extended prose work was an essay upon the contents and dissensions of the commons in ancient Greece and Rome. How Swift's political philosophy was indeed set upon a specific reading of what happened in ancient Greece and what happened in ancient Rome, and attempted to draw conclusions from that. That then enables him to link the Anglo-Ireland of the 18th century back with ancient Rome, forget about Greece for a moment, back with ancient Rome, and also with modern Rome, which is the Roman Muslim. Also, with, as it happens, the Neapolitan, early 18th century philosopher of politics and much else, Gian Battista Vico. Interesting, particularly for those people who are interested in Joyce, because, as Yeats acknowledges, it's one of the relatively few places where he does acknowledge the existence of Joyce, Finnegan's Wake is, in fact, very much written under the influence of Vico and the Viconian idea of a cyclical movement through history. Thus, he as it were, argues himself out of round a very tight corner indeed, in order to establish, as he wants to do now, the preeminence of Anglo-Irish faith, particularly as embodied in the First Matthew Swift. Then after this, the tension is let down, the essential political and historical paradigms have been set up for those who are really attempting. The requisite information about who Swift was has been given to those people in the audience who need that. We've had the situation of the seance set up. Now we can afford some comedy, and really very funny it is. We discover the other people who are coming to the seance. Abram Johnson, who is an evangelical revivalist and who wants to improve his technique as a revivalist, getting in touch with the great dead revivalist Moody of Moody and Sankey. Mrs. Mallet, who wants information about whether she should buy her tea shop in Folkestone or not. And old Cornelius Patterson. I never did like the heaven they talk about in churches, but when somebody told me that Mrs. Mallet's husband ate and drank and went about with his favourite dog, I said to myself, that's the place for Corley Patterson. I came here to find out if it was true, and I declare to God I've not heard one word about it. Dr. Trench, who is the authority, then has some of them are, we now learn that previous seances have been disrupted by some bad spirit who has disrupted the seance. Dr. Trench gives the whole theory of the spirit world and the sort of purgatorial existence which spirits lead, which we know about, particularly from the play Purgatory and the Santa Clara Tribune of the Guns also. And then Mrs. Henderson emerges. They go into the seance. Corbett is introduced to her as a skeptic, and he feels a bit embarrassed, but she's very gracious. We were all skeptics once. He must not expect too much from a first seance. He must persevere. They sit down. It's explained that there's a control who is, and this too is comical. My control is a dear little girl called Lulu, who died when she was 5 or 6 years old. She describes the spirit's presence and tells us what spirit wants to speak. Miss McKenna, a verse of a hymn, please, the same we had last time, and will everyone join in the singing, which then they sing this standard 19th century mawkish Episcopalian hymn, which is still in our hymn books. Son of my soul, thou Saviour dear, it is not night if thou be near. And this is enough for Mrs. Henderson then to go into her trance. Then there's a little more introductory play as Lulu comes, begins to transmit, and has to be introduced to Corbett, and she says, you mustn't laugh at the way I talk, and he says, I'm not laughing, Lulu. Nobody must laugh. Lulu does her best, but can't say big, long words. And then she starts. Lulu sees a tall man here, lots of hair on face, and this is identified as Mr. Mallet. Yes, yes, says Mrs. Mallet. But it no sooner started than he is, in fact, elbowed out of the way by Lulu says, speaking through Mrs. Henderson, using a child's voice, it is the bad man who spoiled everything last time. If they won't drive him away, Lulu will scream. that horrible spirit again. Last time he monopolized the seance. He would not let anyone speak but himself. And then Lulu, they have driven that bad man away. Lulu sees a young lady. Isn't my husband there? Says Mrs. Mallet. Man with funny pin gone away. Young lady here. Lulu thinks she must be at a fancy dress party. Such funny clothes, hair all in curls. All bent down on floor near that old man with glasses. And then we realise gradually that this is Vanessa. Mrs. Henderson now takes on both their voices. We hear Swift reproaching Vanessa for having eavesdropped upon him to discover what in heck goes on between him and Stella. Power and dignity of what Swift says is only enhanced by coming after this comic relaxation. Swift speaking through the medium to Vanessa. You sit crouching there. Did you not hear what I said? How dare you question her? I found you an ignorant little girl without intellect, without moral ambition. How many times did I not stay away from great men's houses? How many times forsake the Lord Treasurer? How many times neglect the business of the state that we might read Plutarch together? Very, very accomplished here. Yeats is a great prose writer. He recovers without any appearance of pastiche. He recovers the vocabulary, the syntax, the cadence that Swift himself might use. How many times forsake the Lord Treasurer that we might read Plutarch together? And there, of course, is that ancient name, the ancient worthy, which links back to Corbett having talked about how Swift's real vision was of Roman and Greek virtue re-established in the state. Again, I told you to think in every situation of life, not as Hester Vanhomrigh would think in that situation, but as Cato or Brutus would. And now you behave like some common slut with her ear against the keyhole. And for the really dopey people in the audience, Swift then allows John Corbett to whisper to Miss McKenna, who's standing next to him, who also seems to be pretty much of a dope herself. It is Swift, Jonathan Swift, talking to the woman he called Vanessa. She was christened Hester Vanhomrigh. Vanessa answers. Again, in seriousness, passionately. She is a woman with rights on her side. What in heck goes on? You know I'm in love with you. You know that you want to go to bed with me. Why do you run away? What is it that stops? Is it Stella? You tell me not. Then what else is it? And Swift then has a whole series of explanations. All of them having some truth, we are to understand, but none of them entirely satisfying Hester, Vanessa, nor indeed wholly satisfying us. Then there is this really very beautiful passage. He begins by saying, "Oh, look, there's something wrong with me. I've got something wrong with my head. I have fits of dizziness. I don't want to have children that might run mad." And Vanessa says, and he says, "There is a line of Dryden's." Which people? Dryden was a great poet, just dead, in fact, a cousin of Swift's. There is indeed a great line of Dryden, famous one, "Great wits are sure to madness near allied." He quotes it, she takes him up on it. Yes, I know what you mean. "If you had children, Jonathan, my blood would make them healthy. I will take your hand, I will lay it upon my heart, upon the Vanhomrigh blood that has been healthy for generations." I must say on, Mrs. Henderson in her trance slowly raises her left hand. "That is the first time you have touched my body, Jonathan." Swift's voice. "What do I care if it be healthy? What do I care if it could make mine healthy? Am I to add another to the healthy rascaldom and knavery of the world?" She comes back. "Look at me, Jonathan. Your arrogant intellect separates us. Give me both your hands. I will put them upon my breast." Mrs. Henderson raises her right hand to the level of her left and then raises both to her breast. Vanessa speaks again. "Oh, it is white, the breast is. Oh, it is white. White as the gambler's dice. White ivory dice. Think of the uncertainty. Perhaps a mad child. Perhaps a rascal. Perhaps a knave. Perhaps not, Jonathan. The dice of the intellect are loaded, but I am the common ivory dice." And this is the imagery of ivory, the gambler's dice, the dice of the intellect being loaded. since this is the very crux of the whole play. And we'll go on trying to understand it together. I hope you contributing questions and observations as well as me. On Monday, if by that time you could have read, at any rate, the first half of the essay upon the Words of the Wind upon the window pane, that too we should be able to talk about.
Together with a long introductory essay upon that play, which I hope most of you over the weekend would have been able to read. Did anybody find it? It is in the reserve somewhere? Nobody's found it at all. It's in extra, it's in here. Did you read it now? Haven't I got that on reserve?
I didn't find it in reserve at all.
I didn't find it in the stack either. I checked Meyer. It's not there.
Well, not in that. No, I mean, exploration books, but there's certainly the volume of the play, which it is reprinted. Is that what you looked for?
I looked for that in reserve, in the stacks, and in Meyer. You can find it three places.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. I'll check on that and get it put on reserve. Try to get something put on reserve. Think of some. I don't think you want to read it. However, we can still go on talking. But in fact, I'd like to do so. The three poems that I've put up on the board, I think, are related to this play and to the introductory essay. And I would suggest you put it in your notes and have a look at them, at least three, together with the play and the preface to it, after we've finished talking about it today. The two Byzantium poems, Byzantium and Selling to Byzantium, are in your selection. The other one, The Seven Sages, is not. It's in the collected poems. You will remember that I've read you a bit of it already. It's one of those poems where he rehearses the litany of the great Anglo-Irish 18th century thinkers. Swift, of course, among them. But in fact, I might read some of it later today. However, today I really would like comments and observations from the floor, as they say. However, there are one or two things that I would like to say before before I throw the discussion open, and this is to proceed with the reading that we were two-thirds of the way through by the time we broke up on Friday. I may say, in passing, that I've been talking from time to time about the tedious quiz which I've committed us to having, which is as much of a waste of time for me as for you. And I allowed us how it might be this week. Well, we are in fact running a little behind schedule. I suppose there is a schedule, it's a kind of notion in my mind. I would like us to have the quiz by the time we've been through Irish history. And so I think I'll need the rest of this week to take us in a rapid, helter-skelter fashion through the 19th and the 20th centuries. And so the quiz will be Monday or Tuesday of next week. We got to this passage in the Words upon the window pane, which is really, in many ways, the climax of the passage and an extraordinary one, where the scene, having been set with a great deal of incidental comedy, which, as it were, takes care of people who think of the whole business of spiritualism and seances is a cod anyway. And now the medium, Mrs. Henderson, is in her trance. She is possessed by two voices, one after the other, which we identify and have identified for us by the knowledgeable John Corbett, the Cambridge student in the audience, as the name of Vanessa Estevan Omri, one of the two women in Swift's life, and Swift himself. And there is this extraordinary passage in which Vanessa is speaking to Swift through Mrs. Henderson, the medium, when she prevails upon him, upon Swift, to lay his hand upon her breast, and this is mimed by the medium, and then she says,
Why are you afraid to marry? I know that you desire me as I desire you. Why can we not have children? And he says, he comes up with this pretext about, well, there's something wrong. I mean, I have dizzy fits. There's something wrong in my blood, and I shouldn't have children. And she says, my blood is the blood of the Van Omries who have been healthy through many generations, and perhaps it will purge whatever there is or you think there is in your blood that is wrong. Sure, it's a risk. It's a gamble, but it's sort of gambles everyone should take. And then she has this extraordinary passage in prose, but heaven knows it is poetic in the very motion, the very movement of the thinking and feeling, in which the whiteness of her white breast is identified, because they're talking about the gamble that is involved in propagating, generating children, with the whiteness of the gambler's dice. Give me both your hands, I will put them upon my breast, which is white, white as the gambler's dice, white ivory dice. Think of the uncertainty. Perhaps a matcher, perhaps a rascal, perhaps a knave, perhaps not, Jonathan. The dice of the intellect are loaded, but I am the common ivory dice. Which is an extraordinary sentence. It is not my hands that draw you back. My hands are weak. They could not draw you back if you did not love as I love. You said that you have strong passions. That is true, Jonathan. No man in Ireland is so passionate. That is why you need me. That is why you need children. Nobody has greater need. You are growing old. An old man without children is very solitary. Even his friends, men as old as he, turn away. They turn towards the gun, their children or their children's children. They cannot endure an old man like themselves. Now Mrs. Henderson moves away from the chair, her movements gradually growing convulsive as Vanessa works herself up. You are not too old for the dice, Jonathan, but a few years, if you turn away, will make you an old, miserable, childless man. And then this turn, suddenly in Swift's voice, this actress has got to be quite an actress. Oh God, hear the prayer of Jonathan Swift, that afflicted man, and grant that he may leave to posterity nothing but his intellect that came to him from heaven. Can you play solitude with that mind, Jonathan? Dice, white ivory dice. And Swift's voice, my God, I am left alone with my enemy. Who locked the door? Who locked me in with my enemy? And by this time, Mrs. Henderson is out of the chair, beating upon the door, sinks to the floor. And at this point, back comes the little girl, medium Lulu, and we get suddenly back into the child talk. Bad old man, do not let him come back. Bad old man does not know he is dead. This is a passage which repays the closest or most attentive scrutiny. First thing is the way that Swift speaks about intellect, and indeed Vanessa speaks to him about his intellect. She says, your arrogant intellect separates us. Then she says, the dice of the intellect are loaded, but I am the common ivory dice. And then Swift says, this prayer, oh God, hear the prayer of Jonathan Swift, that afflicted man, and grant that he may leave to posterity nothing but his intellect that came to him from heaven. Now it's easy to misread this passage, to think that it is the familiar plea that we are familiar with from poetry for the last 200 years and from poetry that is written in our midst at this very moment. Poetry which sets up the intellect as a cold, denying, ossifying, sterilizing faculty, and appeals instead to a world which is called emotional or intuitive or imaginative. We even find it said, we find people thinking that this is precisely what the function of poetry and some degree of literature, some degree of art is. And this is in fact a sterile and false dichotomy in any case. It is, for instance, in the thinking of everybody who has seriously thought about this matter through the centuries, it is an extreme and dangerous impoverishment of the notion of the imagination to relate it only with the world of feeling and emotion and not with the world of the mind and intellection. Certainly we know that imagination, and this is in fact, I suppose, the claim that the highest claim that one would make for the faculty which we call imagination, that alone of the human faculties, or perhaps not alone, but peculiarly among the human faculties, it draws together feeling and intellect, heart and head, mind and body. Therefore, the act of the imagination is the act of the total personality, where most of our other acts are acts of partial personality, parts of our personality. We are, at this point, a sensuous creature, at this other point, a highly emotional one, at this other one, a rigorously controlled and disciplined mind. In the act of the imagination, we are all these things together. Well, you may agree or disagree about this. The important thing to realize is that it is a false reading of Yeats to import that dichotomy into a passage like this. He is not siding with Vanessa against Swift. He's not siding with Swift against Vanessa either. But he is not inviting us to think how right Vanessa was, how wrong Swift was to be the arrogant intellect. In other words, intellect in Swift, in Yeats's thinking, this time of his life particularly, but to some degree at any rate, throughout his life, intellect is an okay word. It's a very noble word for what he takes to be a very splendid faculty. In this, he is like William Blake, the earliest of the English predecessors by whom he set his course and on whom, to some degree, he modeled himself, the earliest and one that he never completely outgrew. And about Blake, too, we are often invited to have false ideas. About Blake, too, at the end of the 18th century, we are invited to think that when Blake cries out, as he never ceases to do, in prose and in verse, upon the sterile rationalism, the supposedly sterile rationalism of the thinkers who had preceded him, of Isaac Newton, the scientist, of John Locke, the political philosopher, of Francis Bacon, and of the poets who went with them, people often mistake and say he is standing again for the warm world of feeling and emotion against the cold world of the intellect. This is not so. In Blake, too, the word intellect is a noble faculty, and it is approved of. The point is, or anyway, part of the truth is, that unlike the traditional thinking along these matters, neither for Blake nor for Yeats does intellect equal reason. In both of them, then, we have to imagine a hierarchy of the human faculties in which intellect is noble, reason and the rational, and still more the rationalistic, all these words are slightly different, is in fact a debased and specialized form of intellect. It's at this point that I draw your attention particularly to two of these three poems. To Byzantium, which was written about this time, which is an old man's poem. This is a very difficult poem, more difficult than it ought to be, I think. It's a happy hunting ground of the graduate seminar, winking around extra there's something wrong with a poem, I wish that's true. But, and I hope we don't have to go through all that ourselves, I don't mean to. Nonetheless, one thing at any rate is clear, that in that poem, Byzantium, the medieval word for Constantinople, is the symbol, Yeats makes this absolutely plain, for the splendor of intellect, intellectual endeavor. And in that poem, Byzantium, Yeats is expressing the nobility of that endeavor as far as he's concerned, and how far he finds himself drawn towards it. It's true that there is a companion piece written 5 years before, Sailing to Byzantium, which casts a rather different inflection, which ultimately, at the end of a long, complicated poem, complicated too, but it's better than this one, he in fact does create rather the world of passionate sensuousness. That's to say, we set out in that poem to sail to Byzantium, but we never get there. I'm just as well. And that, so that as often in Yeats, as we shall see, we have two poems on opposite sides of the same argument, or at any rate, on opposite sides, on very different sides. Yeats is not a poet who is afraid to change his mind. On the contrary, as we shall see, one of the ways in which he builds up his collections, one of the ways in which he deals with experience, is to write a poem and then another poem which contradicts it. A dramatic way of writing, in which he's not committing himself, he's pointing out that he can see both sides of these questions. Nonetheless, there is Byzantium to show that intellect was for him a noble thing, and sheerly intellectual achievement was something which he honoured in others and was tempted to in himself. The Seven Sages, which I have made refer to, makes very plain the way in which intellect does not equal reason. You may remember, I read you this passage before, in this poem where seven old men have an unlikely conversation together about Oliver Goldsmith, Barclay and the rest, we come to, one of them asks, they start with, okay, we'll have to read it. My great-grandfather spoke to Edmund Burke in Grattan's house. There are two of the names, Burke and Grattan. The second. My great-grandfather shared a pothouse bench with Oliver Goldsmith once. Number three. The third. My great-grandfather's father talked of music, drank tower water with the Bishop of Cloyne. Bishop of Cloyne, George Barclay, number four, who wrote a treatise on tower water, incidentally. The fourth. But mine saw Stella. By implication. And then the fifth, whence came our thought? Why, what are we thinking about? Precisely fair to ourselves. And the sixth, from four great minds that hated Whiggery. Goldsmith, Grattan, Berkeley, Swift, I mean, five, no, five, four, all right? Now, Burke was a Whig, which he was, in fact. And the sixth, whether they knew or not, Goldsmith and Burke, Swift and the Bishop of Cloyne all hated Whiggery. But what is Whiggery? A levelling, rancorous, rational sort of mind that never look out of the eye of a saint or out of drunkard's eye. And then all's Whiggery now, but we old men are massed against the world. Rancorous sort of, and rational sort of mind. Rational reason. And this is called Whiggery, and plainly, everywhere, Yeats is set against this. Thus, the intellect that he approves and applauds in Swift is not rationalism. It is not the particular and specialized use of the intellect which consists of counting, computing, figuring, making quantitative what differences that are really differences of quality, qualitative, and so on. And of course, Yeats is not alone with it. Yeats and Blake are not alone. Indeed, one must be, I think, perpetually grateful to them for asserting what is, after all, ultimately a traditional and classical frame of mind on these matters. By that, Burke was a Whig, that's to say, in terms actually of the political parties called Whig and Tory, as they existed in 18th century Ireland, 18th century England, and indeed 18th century America, Burke was indeed most of the time operating in the Whig party, and indeed one of the old men could have said that so was Swift at one point. Swift was a Whig when he thought that the Whigs were going to get him into power, and then shifted to the Tories when that was decided. But this use of the words Whig and Tory, highly specific use, historian's use, is not really relevant to what we're talking about here. Apart from anything else, when they say in passing, we and Tory mean very different things in the American colonies from what they mean in England. Well, to go on the point is too that when Vanessa says, you are a passionate man, you have strong passions, no man in Ireland is so passionate, yet Swift does not deny the fact, and Yeats doesn't want to deny it on his behalf. Again, the opposition between intellect, cold, emotionless, impassive, and the rest of it on the one side, and passion, warm, throbbing, extreme, full blooded on the other, is a false dichotomy which has muddled us in literary studies, I'm afraid, for a very long time, and which we can never hold the scotch. But of course, Yeats would say, and I think he would be right, that the great intellect are intellects driven by passion. But there is such a thing, heaven knows, and it's a very valuable thing too, as a passionate intellectualism or an intellectual passion. This is the assertion of this in the early 20th century we may associate particularly with the not rediscovery, though people say rediscovery, but the great attention given by particularly Eliot, though by others before and after him, to John Donne and to the 17th century metaphysical poets in general. Any those of you who have studied those poets at all and have studied what modern criticism has to say about them will realise that this is very markedly the case that is made. Instead of deciding, is this emotional or is it intellectual, in order to respond to the great poems of Donne and of some of the other 17th century poets, like Herbert, like Andrew Marvell, you have, on the contrary, to realise that the poem is ferociously ingenious and intellectually strong, precisely because it is motivated by a passionate engagement. And hence it represents a healing of these false divisions that we impose upon ourselves. Yeats would certainly agree with that. And Yeats, indeed, was influenced very strongly indeed by the rediscovery of Donne and his 17th century peers, by the first scholarly complete edition of Donne, which is still basically the one that we use, the one by Herbert Grierson in 1912, and the letters that were exchanged between Grierson and Yeats and Grierson shows that Donne had, in fact, as much impact upon Yeats as